Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I want to be a billionaire so fucking bad. Buy all of the things I never had.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to meet Chuck Collins, no relation to your humble host. He was an heir to a big fortune, and he gave it away. He spent the last 30 years fighting for income and wealth equality in this country. Before we heard about the 1%, Chuck Collins was scheming with Bill Gates Sr. and other rich and formerly rich guys to draw attention to the tragic divide in the economy of the average American. You know what I mean. Before we get started, I want to thank the people who have not yet made me a billionaire, but they helped me squeak by here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscription dollars. People like Anna Gordonier, Kevin Beckley, Keith Hull, and Pauline Nixon. They help keep this whole thing going, and I'd like you to help too. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. And unless you are just flat broke, I encourage you to take out a subscription. $5, $10, $20 a month, the $50 annual subscription. We've got the Peter B. Collins app that's available for iPhones and iPads at the Apple App Store. There are many ways you can access this program and different ways you can support it, too. I appreciate that you listen, and I hope you can help out as well. Chuck Collins returns to the Peter B. Collins Show today. His new book is called Born on Third Base, where he describes how he gave up his share of the fortune of the Oscar Mayer Meatpacking Company.
Hello, Peter. Good to be with you.
And Chuck, I trotted out the old Oscar Mayer Wiener song because when I was a kid growing up in Cincinnati, they played that about every hour on the kid shows. Uncle Al and Skipper Ryle were the shows that were on our local channel. And Oscar Mayer was a major sponsor. I can still summon the words if I have to.
It is an amazing earworm of a jingle.
Yes, it is. So I want to give the full title of your book. On this program, we do try to push back on subtitle creep, but yours is great. The title of the book, Born on Third Base, a 1%er makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. And Chuck, you've been at this for a long time. At the age of 26, you renounced or just handed off your share of your family fortune.
Yeah, I was 26. I had my parents, you know, had set up an education trust fund for me, and I was fortunate. I feel like I, you know, got a debt-free college education, but this was the early '80s, and thanks to Ronald Reagan and sort of the policies that helped expand wealth for the already wealthy, I literally watched these assets in my name double over like a 4-year period, and it just didn't make sense to me. I didn't feel like I had a claim on it. I know that my ancestors had worked hard and my parents had worked to make that possible for me, but it just wasn't right for me. And I could see the urgent needs around me, so I wanted to move the money along. So at the age of 26, without any family obligations, I made that decision.
And what, 30 plus years later, almost 40, did you make the right call?
I lost you. I can't hear you for some reason.
I'm sorry. I muted because my dog Chloe was barking.
I know. Probably that Oscar Mayer Jingle did that.
Yeah, she gets excited about hot dogs. So do you have any regrets almost 40 years later that you gave up a substantial amount of wealth?
I don't have any regrets. It's definitely, you know, changed the trajectory of my life. One thing it helped me discover is just how much other privilege I have. You know, the money representing one aspect of it, but, you know, coming from a family, three generations of homeowners, family wealth, you know, access to healthcare, being, you know, born white. There's a mountain of other privilege that I still have. But I don't have any regrets. And actually, I feel like it allowed me to do the work that I do, which is kind of unflinchingly look at how these inequalities are really affecting everybody and undermining the quality of life for everybody, including the wealthy.
And let me just share a personal story, because inheritance of large amounts of money is not always a good thing. It can be a significant liability. And I have four cousins whose grandfather invented formica. And as a result, there were trusts that were set up. And each of these cousins of mine received $1 million at the age of 25, another million at the age of 30, and I don't know how much more in stock was transferred to them later. Two of them went through the money in about a five-year period, and they currently live very hand-to-mouth, almost a subsistence living. The other two, you know, handled the money fairly wisely, to my knowledge. And they, you know, live on that inheritance today. And you know, the life patterns of these four people were all very different, but their access to big money early shaped them in ways that, are not all good. And I just mention that because I think that, you know, so many people just imagine that their lives would be perfect. They would be fixed if I just had that $1 million, you know. And money does not always solve those problems.
No, I mean, you know, Andrew Carnegie in his famous essay, Wealth, said, you know, if I want to curse my child, I'll give them an inheritance. And there's some wisdom there. I mean, I think it's true that some people can figure out how to proceed in life. But I think for a lot of people, it's disorienting, in part because work is such an important part of our identities, and it's such an important part of how we make meaning in our society. We all need to contribute. And I think to be in a situation where you actually don't have to work, as wonderful as that may sound, disconnects people from community and society, and isolates them in unfortunate ways. So there's along with the upsides, there's a huge number of downsides.
As you describe in the book, Born on Third Base, Chuck Collins, you grew up in Bloomfield Hills, which is one of the wealthiest suburbs in the Detroit, Michigan area. And you also went to a private school called Cranbrook, where Mitt Romney was matriculating in the same relative time period. And in the book, you describe your ambivalence about going back and talking to a group of people in your old neighborhood. Talk a little bit about those tensions that you feel.
Well, I think, you know, I left Bloomfield Hills at age 17, and it was really around that time that I was really starting to understand kind of where I fit in, that Bloomfield Hills was really one of the wealthiest communities in the Midwest. And I sort of, you know, left and didn't turn back at age 17. I was very ambivalent about, you know, when people would say, well, where are you from? I'd say, well, I'm from Detroit. And they'd say, well, really, like, where are you from?
Right.
I'd still fudge it, you know, Birmingham or Royal Oak. I just couldn't say the words Bloomfield Hills, because there's a lot, you know, even today, you know, I was reading a story about the Flint, you know, lead water issue,
right,
in Flint, Michigan. And they said, now, if this had happened in Bloomfield Hills, something would have been done, you know. So Bloomfield Hills is really a proxy for super rich. And but what I did, you know, what I forgot was, first of all, there were some amazing people in my community that helped raise me, other parents and teachers and coaches and mentors. It wasn't a terrible community. There's a lot of good things going on there. There was a lot of odd things. You know, there were no public parks, no public recreation. It was all private country clubs.
Well, in fact, when I was there in July, my friends who lived there belonged to a private club that has its own lake. And so we went down to the lake and had a little picnic. And I'm sure there aren't any explicit rules that deny entry to people of color or people who aren't rich, but it's simply limited to people who live there. And it's like Cape Cod and many other parts of the United States where the land rules are set up to favor those who own land already. And so public parks, public access, who needs it? We own it.
Exactly. No, it's the complete privatization of recreation. So recently I went back. In fact, I was there in January, just as I was trying to finish the book Born on Third Base, and I gave a talk at a church that I had grown up going to, and I was sort of overcome with both being moved by the people who were there. A lot of my teachers and friends and people who are still there came out and were encouraging and were really talking about really deeply concerned about these issues of growing wealth inequality and the racial wealth divide. And it was just like I felt a little bit of shame, like I had slandered them or I had kind of created a cartoon caricature in my head about who these people were, when in fact these are potential allies in the movement to reduce inequality. So my shout out is to, you know, those were my people, you know, and I can't walk away from them. Sometimes you don't want to go home for various reasons, but I kind of personally committed to stay connected back to the community that raised me.
And maybe part of this, I'm not trying to be a nitpicker here or to, challenge you on a silly issue, but you're really a former one percenter. You were born into wealth. You rejected that. And I don't believe that you have, sold an app to Facebook and cashed in the interim. So isn't it a fact that you're a former one percenter? And shouldn't those misgivings and those feelings of shame kind of be dismissed because you're no longer part of the problem?
Absolutely. In fact, I actually wanted the publisher to write, put parentheses in the title, you know, former one percenter. Because that's part of my identity, and it is actually maybe part of the reason I can go back without the complexity is like I made my life choice in a certain way, and I don't think everybody has to do what I did, but it's given me some peace and contentment there. I do think it's significant to grow up in the 1% because that's so much of how we're kind of imprinted. Just like my friends who were raised in low-income or poor families imprints them, our class of origin really does have a huge impact on us. But the reality is I live in a very, you know, I work for a living and I don't have, you know, I have some modest savings and I live in I'm stably in the third quintile of income and wealth in the United States.
Well, and I want to talk about your local activism in Jamaica Plain a little bit later. As we look at the current political landscape, I really applaud what you're doing. You're out on a book tour promoting your message, and other members of the Patriotic Millionaires are fanning out across the country. And early on in this cycle, we saw Bernie Sanders raise these very important questions and get a dramatic response about income and wealth inequality. And he tried, I think, his best to get the platform of the Democratic Party to reflect that. But Hillary Clinton is not Bernie Sanders, and she's running a different race aimed at different people. She assumes that those who care about income inequality and wealth inequality are really wedged into the Democratic Party and have nowhere else to go. So she's more interested in courting, independent voters and some Republicans in a desperate effort to beat Donald Trump. And he, of course, turns the wealth and inequality issues on their proverbial ears. So are you having difficulty connecting in the current media environment where, this message is no longer front and center?
I find it quite the contrary, actually. I think people are eager to talk about these inequalities. It's like an undercurrent. For another month, we'll be in, sort of deep election mode, and that will narrow the conversation a bit. But at the base, I see people eager to say, how are we going to fix this? And regardless of who is elected president, what are the things that we should be doing in our communities and in our organizing work to do that? And I think the Patriotic Millionaires group, as well as others, are not only saying, well, what would be the policies that would reverse these inequalities, but also how do we change the story of, that justify these inequalities? Because a lot, some people will hear the Bernie Sanders or others talk about, the 1% has, 36% of all the wealth, and most of the income and wealth gains have gone to the top 1/10 of 1%. But other people will be kind of like, ho-hum, that's because those people worked harder and they got up earlier in the morning and they're more virtuous. So they take that story of personal virtue and deservedness and kind of put it on this large mega trend. And I think that Patriotic Millionaires my hope for this book is that we can kind of change the stories that justify these inequalities. But I think there's a movement growing, and I particularly think of younger people. I have three young adults who are all, super into Bernie Sanders, feel somewhat betrayed by the system right now. We're kind of trying to walk them back off the cliff there. I also worked very hard, because I think Bernie was the messenger on these issues. But I think that the movement will continue, and particularly younger people are going to be very important because they're really affected by these growing inequalities.
And do you buy into Bernie's pivot that, obviously Clinton is better than Trump on almost any measure? At the same time, there are so many defects in the Clinton candidacy, and I'm not making this personal. It's about her positions on the issues, her coziness with corporate interests. We've got this story today from the Daily Beast about how she went to bat for Chevron when she was Secretary of State, and her ties with corporate interests, the personal wealth that the Clintons have built up since they left the White House. All of these make it very difficult for people like me to suck it up and vote for Hillary Clinton, especially in a state like California, where I know that my vote is not going to make a pivotal difference.
Well, I share, all those feelings. And, when Hillary Clinton says she's opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, I just have to look back at her history and, who she respects and associates with. And, it is the free traders wing of the Democratic Party. I just can't imagine that if she's the president 6 months from now, we'll have a new, slightly watered down version of that trade agreement that she's going to say, well, now this has addressed all my concerns and I'm going to advance it. So I think people are right to point to that, for instance, as an example where, where do you really stand?
Well, and, she named Ken Salazar to head her transition team, and, he's in bed with oil and gas and international trade. His record in the Senate was awful. And so to see him as a gatekeeper for people who want to go to work in a Clinton administration, it's just another negative.
Yeah, I think our kind of work going forward is the same, which is... and I think it's important to stop the sort of Trump values, the Trump messaging, the decisively push back on, what he represents. I think that's an important thing to do on November 9th, or November 8th. But, but immediately after, I think it's rebuilding, whether it's, students organizing against student debt, climate activists trying to, pass, carbon taxation, all those kind of grassroots movements that ultimately I think Hillary Clinton would be more responsive to if we can create the kind of pressure. That's the work is pretty much the same no matter what.
And Chuck, as I read your book and the many angles that you've taken, the creative messaging that you have utilized, I really respect the work that you do. And fundamentally, I think that you are agitating against greed, and greed is a wily opponent, and it really is something that is so heavily promoted in the United States that I have to ask if you haven't already reached the millionaires and billionaires who have a conscience and who care beyond, you know, their own bank accounts and buying a third home. And greed is such an almost intractable human defect. And it is so aggrandized in the American culture. I just want you to take a moment here and talk about that very fundamental struggle that you're engaged in.
Well, I think that you know, sort of short-term materialism is one of the things that greed and reaching for more, never having enough. But my way I look at it is there's a small segment of the very, very rich who use their wealth and power to rig the rules to get more wealth and power. And then there's, you know, our side of people like in the patriotic millionaires and others who are sort of speaking out about the rules that worsen inequality. And then there's this vast, unengaged group, even within the 1%, very much like the rest of society, who aren't really paying that much attention, who are kind of, you know, enjoying the comforts of privilege and wealth, but are leading fairly hollowed out, disconnected lives. And I think that's the audience that, you know, I'm reaching out to in Born on Third Base, which is my, you know, is to say, look, there's another way to live here. Bring your wealth home. My message to the 1% is come home. Bring your wealth and your stake in the good society. You know, put down your stake in a place. You know, if it's in Detroit, in the Detroit area, adopt the whole city. You know, if it's in San Francisco, adopt the Tenderloin. If it's, you know, Los Angeles, adopt this, you know, central LA. What, you know, make your community, put your stake down, take your wealth out of the offshore tax havens, out of the global financial casino that isn't really creating any real value. It's just speculation, and reinvest it in the real economy in these places. Support the emerging entrepreneurs, support community businesses and cooperatives that spread the wealth around. And coming home also means just showing up, being back in a place and in relationship with others. And I think there's a lot of people out there waiting to be invited to the table and waiting to reconnect that don't know how to do that. So that's my hope, is that it's, you know, life, there's more to life than accumulating toys, you know. I grew up in a house, we had the mug, you know, the person with the most toys wins when they die. You know, the person with the most toys when they die wins. And that's really not what it's about. You know, it's really about community and connection.
In one chapter entitled "I Didn't Do It Alone," you talk about how many entrepreneurs, particularly the way they're celebrated, say, in Forbes magazine, they believe that they were magical and that they created something and that they did it all themselves. And think back to 2012, when an offhand comment by President Obama that, hey, you know, the highway that connects your factory so that you can haul your manufactured goods to market, you didn't build that. And the Republicans seized on that and instantly made it the theme for their convention, the Romney Convention. And they were oblivious to the contradictory nature of the message that they were embracing. But it appeared to work for rank-and-file Republicans who said, yeah, you know, we're the bootstrappers. We did it all ourselves, and it's these leeches, the takers, the 47% that Romney was talking about that are dragging down our economy. And, you know, this is fatuous at least and insidious at its worst. And yet many people just say, oh, yeah, that makes sense to me.
Well, this is, I think, the battle of the story, you know, the battle of how wealth is created in our society. And, you know, there are people who really adopt this I did it alone story. But if you kind of dig deeper into that or have a real conversation with them and say, really, were you kind of raised by wolves in the wild? You know, did you go to a high school? Were you in a community? Did you benefit at all from public investments? Did you get a scholarship anywhere? You know, you start to engage on, oh, you actually didn't do it alone. And that's why I think it's important. And in the book Born on Third Base, I really try to tell stories, lift up examples of people who tell their story quite differently. And it's not to say individuals don't matter. You know, what people do matters, and individual effort and creativity matters. But we exist in a society that is this fertile ground for wealth creation, thanks to the people who came before us and the public investments and the things that all of us contribute. So it's a very warped way of looking at the world, and it's exactly the story battleground, if you will, that I think we need to engage on.
And Chuck, to take it one layer down, what you just described is very much small C Christian. You're talking about a sense of social obligation and community that I see as, you know, consistent with many people's religious values. And the Republican Party touts that it's the party of religious values. And yet these are in direct conflict with the projection of wealth and entrepreneurship as a core value of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, a Christian perspective on wealth is no one does it alone. It's a function of grace. We have been given these gifts, and the proper response is not to thump one's chest and say, I did it, but to recognize it's a gift, and it should be passed on. I mean, I actually did a book a couple years ago on Christian teachings on the economy. And there's some very powerful principles, one being that there's a social mortgage on capital, meaning society, there is no such thing as absolute individual ownership. Everything is webbed together, and society has a social mortgage on capital, meaning it has a claim on the wealth because it comes from society. And ecologically, it comes from nature. And actually, that's one of the points I make is, look, you know, what is wealth on a degraded planet? You know, what is wealth in a planet where we've degraded our water and destroyed our spaceship, if you will? So another reason why I think wealthy people can be engaged at this moment is to say, look where we're going here. We need to all step up. Everybody's webbed together here. There is no planet B. There's no spaceship Elysium that you can go live on. That looks like Malibu Beach. You know, that is a delusion, and so it is completely, entirely in your self-interest, if you're a wealthy person, to get in there and fix the future.
We're talking with Chuck Collins. His latest book is Born on Third Base. And Chuck, for me, the most intriguing chapter in the book, with the most clever chapter title, is Miro in the Bathroom: Encounters with the Charitable Industrial Complex. You need to explain the Miro in the Bathroom part, please.
Oh, well, I was pursuing a grant for the work that we're doing on inequality, and I went to the home of a very fabulously wealthy woman who was a trustee of a foundation, and went, you know, with my colleague, Felice Yeskel. She and I co-founded a group called United for a Fair Economy. Mm-hmm. So we went to this woman's house, and it was huge, giant, kind of like a private museum, really, across the street from the Met, 6,000 square feet in one of these giant New York apartment buildings. And I after our meeting, I went to the bathroom, and I said, wow. There, you know, look, there is an original Miro painting on the bathroom wall. And as I was leaving, Felice and I said, did you see the Miro in the bathroom? And she said, no, I didn't see that because, and I, you know, she and I grew up in very different class backgrounds. I was maybe assuming she didn't know who the painter Miro was.
Mm-hmm. Spanish impressionist. Yeah.
Yeah. I know who Miro is, silly, she says, you know, but did you see the Picasso? I said, no. She said, you had to be sitting down to see it. So, okay, so if you were standing up, you got to see the Miro, but if you were sitting down, you got to see the Picasso. But that whole theme there is, you know, people will say, well, you know, isn't the solution to these inequalities increasing charity? You know, shouldn't wealthy people give back through charity? And my very simple message there is charity is not a substitute for justice. And it's not a substitute for paying your fair share of taxes, which is actually what builds the infrastructure and pays for the things that actually really reduce inequality. So I'm somewhat critical of big charity right now, and I don't think it's the solution to these extreme inequalities.
You write, most giving by individuals and foundations flows to large, well-established educational institutions, hospitals, and arts organizations. Only a very small percent, estimated at 3 to 5%, goes to organizations serving the most needy and disenfranchised. And very little money goes to change, not charity, efforts. And explain what you mean by that. You're trying to fund critical social change, not just short-term funding to alleviate symptoms. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, and again, I don't want to, you know, dampen people's sense of generosity. I think that there's a lot of good work that obviously comes about by people sharing. But there's an awful lot of just protecting the status quo, if you will, or actually compounding inequality. There's now a lot of people that give to the foundation in their wealthy community that helps support the public schools. They're reducing their taxes and they're giving money to their schools in a way that just compounds the inequalities between communities. So my point is there is a way to fund change, not charity, where you actually kind of get at the root causes. You know, instead of funding a campaign for Toys for Tots, you fund a living wage campaign so that the workers can afford to buy toys for their own kids, you know. It's not a substitute. You know, what we've seen in the last 30 years is the growth of big philanthropy, these mega foundations that are growing up that are private bastions of power. These are foundations that do what the donor wants. And if it's giving to their old alma mater, if it's giving to Cranbrook or whatever, you know, like my alma mater, is very, very different. And the reason you and I, Peter, have an interest in that is because we effectively subsidize it through the tax code.
Yeah.
You know, we chip in, you know, half of every grant in lost tax revenue. So if somebody wants to just give to their pet project as opposed to build, you know, a new school in a neighborhood, we should have a say over that. So it's just too much unaccountable power that's going into the charitable sector.
And when you talk about change, not charity, that can be a loaded term. We're speaking the day after we've learned that almost 1,000 people have been killed in Haiti by Hurricane Matthew. And after the earthquake, Bill Clinton arrived, the Clinton Foundation. Clinton had a separate title as a UN special envoy. And what the Clintons have done in Haiti is quite offensive to me. They established a new sweatshop in a business park called Caracol. They built some luxury hotels. We have no indication that any Clinton Foundation money has been used to create housing or to deal with the lack of an adequate sewage system that has enabled the UN-introduced cholera epidemic to continue now for years. And so when we look at the impact of big charity, and you know, I'm not gunning for the Clintons again. This is just a real clear and present example of how a foundation is being used, at least as a parallel, a conduit for influence peddling and, you know, empowering the Clintons beyond even what they have been elected to do. And I find this something that we have to be very, very concerned about.
I share that concern. And if you look, in a month, I'm co-authoring a report on what we call top-heavy philanthropy. And it's sort of looking and saying, let's look at the last 20 years. There's been this dramatic increase in private foundations, which sort of parallels the concentration of wealth at the top. And then you have these foundations. They are bastions of private power. They are the extension of somebody's political influence in some cases. Mm-hmm. And that's really not the intent. That was really not the intent. And the fact that they're using the tax code to reduce their taxes and build these institutions, you know, whether it's the Trump Foundation or the Clinton Foundation or Soros on the left and, you know, the Kochs on the right, you know, we should be very concerned that, you know, the growing number of billionaires, all of whom have charitable foundations, we'll just keep seeing the growth of these private big philanthropy institutions. I mean, 20 years from now, we're going to have, you know, 50 mega billion foundations dictating education policy and the like, while our governments will be squirming with austerity, trying to get by with less and less money. That's where we're heading here.
And one of your colleagues in pursuit of, better equity in both wealth and income is Bill Gates Sr. And without asking you to delve into, you know, purely private conversations, your criticism of big foundations could be applied to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I want to clearly separate them from my critique of the Clinton Foundation. I don't think that the Gates Foundation is trying to peddle political influence. At the same time, the characteristics that you just described do apply to that foundation. Tell me your thoughts.
Well, I think, you know, any big philanthropy to me is a concern. And actually, Bill Gates Sr. Really understands that, actually. I remember him, he once said to me, you know, there's something wrong where my son is going to give all this wealth to this charity and he's not going to pay any taxes on the $90 billion, you know. There's something wrong with that. And what I appreciate about him was he really stuck his neck out and became a champion of wealth taxation, of creating and maintaining a robust estate tax and effectively an inheritance tax. And I think that's where we want to go. We should, you know, maybe cap the amount of money that can be given to charity with a deduction. You know, if you want to give all your money away, that's fine. But if you give over X millions of dollars, it's no longer going to be subsidized by the rest of us. And you're going to have to pay taxes on that wealth. And I think that would strike a better balance. You know, people would still give to charity, but they still also pay for the infrastructure that we need and national defense and the protection of national parks and on and on. Wealthy billionaires should not be opting out of their fair share of the tab.
And Chuck, I have this love-hate relationship with Apple Computer. I've done some work for the company in the past. I have almost one of every kind of gadget that they manufacture. I like many things about Apple. But I also deplore their offshore manufacturing, often in sweatshop conditions, and their tax cheating. It's not simple evasion or avoidance. It is cheating, in my view. And they've been caught by the European Union in the tax dodge that they employed in Ireland with the double Dutch Brussels bypass or whatever that's called.
Well, I think the message there is, I like the products, but hate the tax dodger. Apple, you know, games the system because they create subsidiaries in these offshore tax havens. And it's a good example of a company that has enormously benefited from tax expenditures in this country. I mean, we built this together through scientific research, the platforms of the internet, and a lot of the technologies that Apple has built upon. And they should pay back the society that helped them create the wealth that they've benefited, you know, they've grown. So the United States could actually play a huge role in closing down this whole offshore tax system and series of abuses. You know, using our trade power, we could say, yeah, you want to do business in the United States? You have to have complete transparency in tax payments. And you have to have country-by-country reporting. And you can't create a subsidiary just for the purpose of dodging taxes. And we could wave our political wand and end these abuses that Apple and Boeing and General Electric and all these other companies use.
And right before that, we would have to reform the campaign finance system so there would be votes in the Congress to enact a law like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, our national political system is effectively captured by a couple thousand transnational corporations and some very wealthy donors. And you know, with the Bernie Sanders campaign, you could see the potential of small donors as a movement shifting things. And you can see that with Move On and other groups like that. So we can do only so much by aggregating people power to make these changes. we also have to just limit the influence and the politicians who are indebted to a very small interest group.
Mm-hmm.
We know that politically, the public wants to close down these offshore tax havens, make sure the wealthy pay their fair share, raise the minimum wage. There's, you know, the program to reduce inequality in this country is wildly popular. So we're just waiting for that. You know, the pressure is building for some kind of realignment in the coming years.
Well, I'd sure love to see that. Chuck, I'm intrigued by the work that you describe you do in your adopted home of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. That's outside Boston. And let me ask you to begin by describing, after the 2008 economic meltdown, you and others helped form a resilience circle. And this reminds me of some anarchists who came into New Orleans after Katrina and set up a kind of mutual aid, person to person, rather than based on any government or organizations, outside organizations involved. Tell our listeners about the resilience circle idea.
Well, you know, if you think back to, you know, September and October of 2008, and just how many people felt vulnerable and insecure in the changing economic moment. People were losing their jobs, losing their savings, uncertain for the future. And there were a lot of people, I would call them, you know, who believed that they were economically self-sufficient, and all of a sudden realized they were completely at risk. And in my own religious, in my own church, we formed a resilience circle, and we, you know, we helped to support a movement of these, what we call resilience circles around the country, which were small groups of people looking at, you know, supporting each other through mutual aid, but also looking at how did we get into this mess and how can we make sure this doesn't happen again. So there was sort of both a mutual aid and a sort of education and social action element of these resilience circles. And there were, at a certain point, several hundred of them around the country of people coming together to help each other. And I think that we may be back in a similar fix in the future where we, you know, where we have to depend on our neighbors as kind of our first responders, if you will. And I was heartened to see just how open people were to that approach.
Mm-hmm. And this, in some ways, led to the formation of what you call JPNET, Jamaica Plain New Economy Transition. Tell our listeners a little about that, please.
Well, we formed, you know, one of the things we realized is, well, you know, there's limits to what you can do just among a group of friends or a resilience circle. And there's really a global movement called the Transition Movement, which is communities coming together to sort of face the future, look at the changing economy and climate change and how that's going to influence the economy of the future. And what is it we can proactively do together, like building a new food system, reducing our dependence on external energy, figuring out how to create more jobs and livelihoods that are rooted in a locality. Those are all the kinds of things that we've been doing through this Jamaica Plain New Economy Transition. And we've been inspired by similar efforts around New England and around the world.
Well, it's very interesting, and you are acting locally and having an influence well beyond that globally thing, too.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a place where you know, sometimes if you look at, well, how do you change federal laws, it's like running into a brick wall. I do think we have a lot of potential, but I think starting at the local level, building, you know, reweaving the social fabric at the local level, neighbors knowing neighbors, helping neighbors, is the foundation for a political movement that can change the country. And so having a place where what you do matters and you have a sense of agency is very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chuck, I want to thank you for joining us today, and I really enjoyed your new book, Born on Third Base. We have to credit former Texas Governor Ann Richards for that phrase. She applied it to George W. Bush way back there in the 90s. And I think that you do excellent work, and I hope you will continue to fight for the interests of those in the so-called 99%.
Well, thank you, Peter, for the conversation. And if your listeners are interested, you can learn more at inequality.org. which is the website that I help co-edit, and there's information about the book and all these inequality issues that we've talked about.
Chuck Collins, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Chuck Collins. I welcome your comments and feedback. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.